Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
What polling tries to do is something that no other real institution in the society does, and that is it tries to give everybody a voice.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? A philosophical defense of the polling industry, or polling as an informational pillar of American democracy. Not quite what you'd expect after November 2020, which, much like November 2016 before it, yielded this kind of headline.
Three solid Trump wins in Texas, Ohio, and Iowa after the polls forecast a toss-up. That's bad.
Joe Biden held a comfortable lead over Donald Trump in Wisconsin heading into Election Day. At least that's what the polling showed.
The race was incredibly close, and very few polls picked that.
The pollsters at CNN and a few other places have not apologized for numbers that are completely wrong.
The rout of President Trump and his party, predicted by many polls, didn't happen.
Nope, it didn't. And yes, there will be lots of analysis, lots of dispute about what went wrong and just how wrong the polls were. But should the polling baby be thrown out with the murky, inaccurate bathwater we've all been wading in the past two presidential cycles?
You know, I don't think that your own views of what public opinion are based on the people around you is a very good way to make judgments about what the public thinks, because the public is too diverse.
This is Scott Keeter, senior survey advisor at the Pew Research Center in Washington.
And similarly, to hear it from our leaders, they have a self-interested point of view about this, and their views of what the public think probably aren't accurate. So polls offer something that no other institution can offer. Polling tries to let everybody have a say-so.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point, and you know we here at On Point love nothing more than a provocative thesis. And the assertion that modern-day polling, warts, margins of error and all, provides a democratic service that no other institution in this country currently offers, well, that's the kind of hypothesis that we love to test. So, we will this hour. How is polling supposed to work? Why did it seem to fail twice in such important elections? And is it really the best tool out there? Or are there better ways to discern how Americans think about the most important issues facing the country? So let's start with that first question. Ideally, how is polling supposed to work? That's why we turned to Scott Keeter at the Pew Center in Washington, one of the most trusted polling organizations in the country. He says step one, money.
The question is, how much do you want to spend on this?
Keeter says a high-quality presidential poll can cost as much as $200,000. So budget goes a long way in determining how good a final data set might be. Step two, finding that all-important representative sample.
Ideally, you draw a sample in such a way that everybody in the population had a chance of being included and that you know what that chance was, because that's critical to making the math work for doing the generalization.
And you can do this by
random digit dialing, which is the creation of phone numbers that represent all of the possible phone numbers in the country, including cell phones. But a lot of other pollsters drew from registered voter samples. After all, they're interested in generalizing to the population of people who are going to vote on Election Day or early. So if you notice polling in the election, a lot of the polls have 800 interviews or 1,000 people. And polls of that size can provide reasonably accurate readings of the views of the larger population that you're trying to generalize to.
Now, here's where the question always comes up. How can such a small number accurately capture what's happening across an electorate of hundreds of millions of people? Well, Keeter says the efficacy of small sample sizes is something that's more familiar than you'd think.
This comes down to the question of, do you really need to eat the whole pot of soup to know if it's too salty? Can't you just stir it and take a spoonful? So in a population where the population is well mixed up, it may be very diverse, but you try to draw your samples from all over the country, giving every region of the country and every kind of person a chance to be in your sample, then when you pull that spoonful out, even if it's a fairly small spoonful, it will be representative of the population within a known margin of error. You're still going to be able to tell how salty the soup is.
Mm-hmm. So you've got your representative sample. That in and of itself is a huge challenge in modern polling. But remember, we're starting today with a baseline for now, the ideal polling scenario. So next,
you have to decide on a way to actually interview people. What are you going to do? Are you going to call them on the phone or interview them on the web or send them a mail survey or what?
Now, that one issue, the means of contact, opens up an entire Pandora's box of potential problems, which we'll discuss later. For now, let's presume that our ideal poll has the right number of willing respondents, and they've answered the question about who they're going to vote for.
It's your best estimation of the share of the relevant population that supports each of the two candidates.
At that time.
But usually we're not interested in that time. We're interested in what it says about what's going to happen on election day. So there are a couple of other steps here. One of them is the age-old problem that pollsters have confronted since the dawn of election polling, and that is, who's really going to vote? If we were a country where 90 or 95% of eligible people voted, this wouldn't be a necessary step. But in a country where it's a shocking and pleasant surprise that 66% of the public voted, you're going to talk to a lot of people who are going to tell you that they intend to vote, but who will not vote.
Keeter says pollsters inject more questions into their analysis, including examining voting patterns, to determine exactly who's going to be that likely voter, the strength of their commitment to vote, as he says. So do you think that the media does a good job in how it reports those numbers from the polls? Because they always give the two sets of numbers and the head-to-heads, and then they just throw out, and the margin of error was 4%. And sometimes, if the numbers are close, you'll hear reporters or anchors say, this is a personal pet peeve of mine, which means it's a statistical tie if they're within the margin of error. Are you laughing?
Yes. You're on to a very good point here, and I want to say this without angering any of my friends at the news organizations who do polling. In the main, the news organizations simply don't have either the expertise or the time to give the reader that kind of sense of what the weight of the evidence really says. So a lot of bad reporting does creep into the feed. And I think, to the question of the uncertainty, some of this is on us as pollsters. If we stress the uncertainty, it sounds like we don't trust our work. But it's something that all of us in the business struggle with. How do we get across the fact that the results just can't be depended upon to be as precise as people want them to be?
That's Scott Keeter, Senior Survey Advisor at the Pew Research Center in Washington, getting us started with our examination today about the failures of American polling, beginning with that ideal scenario about how it's actually supposed to work. Well, joining us now is Natalie Jackson. She's Research Director at the Public Religions Research Institute and an adjunct professor at American University. Natalie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So I always like to start off with a baseline as a place to say, here's how things are supposed to work so we can really judge how broken things are, okay? So give me your assessment, first of all. How do you think the pollsters did in the 2020 election?
It is clear that we've had some struggles in both 2016 and 2020 with measuring Trump support. So I want to start with kind of that baseline of acknowledging that yes, that is a struggle. I do think that, you know, pollsters were cautioning, you know, the Wednesday after the election and later that week, that we needed to kind of hold our horses a little bit before we started castigating the polls and saying that they're so wrong, because we didn't know what those margins would be. I think it's clear now that we, you know, definitely underestimated Trump support, but the narrative of the polls were wrong really took off on Tuesday night when things looked bad for Biden and better for Trump. And even though we knew that pattern was going to reverse, the narrative still took off. So I think there's a bit of sorting between the narrative and the actual problem that has to happen on top of dealing with the actual problem.
Okay, so let's do that sorting first, because a couple of things. One is that perhaps one of the reasons why there was a quick piling on of the polling industry is that, you know, these issues were supposed to have been remedied after 2016 when the pollsters were saying Hillary Clinton was going to be the president of the United States. And then in 2020, for example, in some of the swing states, polling had Joe Biden up by double digits. And in almost all of those swing states, except for Arizona, if I remember correctly, President Trump actually outperformed every single one of those polls. So it seemed like a deja vu problem that that America was promised not to have to endure again. So how would you parse the narrative versus what actually went wrong?
Well, first, I would point out that it wasn't pollsters themselves saying Hillary Clinton would win in 2016. That was the role of the forecasters, of which I was one of in 2016, full disclosure. And pollsters generally, the responsible ones, have always pushed that there is uncertainty, that things may not be correct. And even, you know, I was looking back through a lot of what pollsters said about addressing the problems of 2016 headed into the 2020 election. And almost without fail, the pollsters were quoted as saying, but there could be other problems. There could be other things that crop up. We don't know for sure. So there's a disconnect between the messages that go out and what the responsible pollsters are saying.
So, Natalie, hold on there for just a second, because we have a lot more to explore about that disconnect when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're exploring what happened with polling again in November 2020, and also want to tackle this bigger thesis about if American polling isn't up to snuff in terms of understanding how American voters think and feel about important issues facing this country, what other tools do we have to get a sense of where the electorate is? And I'm joined today by Natalie Jackson. She's research director at Public Religion Research Institute and an adjunct professor at American University. So, Natalie, let's dig into more about actually what happened here in November of this month of 2020. But first, I want to have you tell me more about a really important distinction here, because I think the terms forecast and polling get too often conflated in terms of how we talk about this information, because polls are not the forecasts, right? So tell me, like, how would you draw the bright line between the two?
You know, there is a lot of confusion, and it's perpetuated in part because forecasters often get referred to as pollsters. But here's the basic difference. Pollsters are the ones going out and gathering the data and reporting back that in this national poll of 1,000 voters, Joe Biden has 52% support compared to Donald Trump's 43% support, for example. There are two additional levels of analysts who take the polling data that we get and put it together. So we have aggregators. And those emerged in the early 2000s as a way to deal with lots and lots of polling information as the field kind of started proliferating and we started getting more and more election polls. Aggregation is just a way to model it and put it all together so that you see on any given day what the polls kind of on average look like. Forecasting takes that a step farther and builds models out to predict what's going to happen. So they're using more than just polling data, although in the Nate Silver form, The Economist was the other big player this cycle. In those types of models, polling is kind of the basis for that, and they are aggregating polls and then using polls plus other data to project what they think will happen, usually as a probability. You know, we saw, I believe, 538 toward the end was 90% probability that Joe Biden would win. So the difference is pollsters are the data creators and the data generators. Well, actually, Americans are the data creators because it's their voices. But forecasters are analysts taking that data and creating a different product out of it.
So is that part of the problem, though, in that we are taking data that pollsters themselves are vociferously asserting is just a snapshot in time? And forecasters are trying to take that snapshot and divine something that might happen in the future. I mean, is there anything within a snapshot set of data that should allow an accurate forecast?
You know, I've been watching the field develop over the last 15 years that I've been active in it, and it's really developed into this ecosystem that kind of has a life of its own. Pollsters generate this data. They want media to pick it up. Aggregates and forecasts provide additional exposure. Forecasters and aggregators want polls to feed their models and generate their products. And the media wants all of this to drive attention to a 24-hour news cycle. And of course, as consumers, we all want the world at our fingertips 24 hours a day. And we think future election outcomes should be too. So it's kind of a multifaceted, you know, the whole ecosystem has participated in creating this expectation that polls will be predictive, including pollsters when they put out press releases post-election saying, look how great we did. You know, I've seen that happen in prior cycles. I saw that happen in 2012. You know, and the forecasts and forecasters and aggregators are certainly a large part of pushing that message forward even louder. But I do believe, you know, all parts of that ecosystem work together to create this idea that polls should be predictive when in reality it is stretching the data farther than it should go.
It is stretching the data farther than it should go. Okay. So Natalie, what you just said there, I think is very powerful. So for the average American citizen on the receiving end of the media deluge that comes along with each one of these polls and the needle and all the predictive circus that goes around it, what's the tool that people who are consumers of this information need to have in trying to understand it? Should it simply be ignore the forecasts?
You know, I'm not a fan of ignore the polls or ignore the forecasts because I think that is kind of naive to the idea that these things exist and people are going to pay attention to them. I think what we need is more attention to the details. You know, you mentioned earlier that it's complicated. Mm-hmm. Media often doesn't have time, or rather Scott talked about this, where there's often not the time or the expertise to delve into polls. And, you know, we drop a margin of error and we say it's correct within this estimate. But at the same time, we know as pollsters that there are a lot of other sources of error going into that, particularly when you start trying to pick out likely voters. You know, the whole concept of a poll is that you have a population, the American people, that you're trying to sample.
Right.
Well, when you're looking at election polls, you have a population, people who vote, that doesn't exist yet because we haven't had the election. So there's error that comes about there, as well as in other places of the data generation process, that are just not accounted for. And so the media and the public tend to lack this understanding. So when pollsters are saying, you know, be careful with these estimates, they're fuzzy estimates, there's not a clear understanding of that. And, you know, that's not the fault of the media or the public. It's not solely the fault of the pollsters in communicating that either. It's more that we've developed as a society where you need more statistical sense. You know, you need to understand probabilities to be able to consume these. And so I think a big part of what pollsters, as well as forecasters and aggregators, have to engage in is that education with both the media and the public.
I would also say there's a broad cultural intolerance for uncertainty, right? Because, you know, is your tweet going to go viral if you say, here's the latest head-to-head number, but here's all the all the things that it doesn't mean? Here are all the sources of uncertainty within these numbers? I mean, I just don't know if there's, you know, if there's a tolerance for that, especially to your point earlier, given this sort of ecosystem where there's mutual reliance between the media organizations, the polling organizations, the listeners, the viewers, and the readers in terms of spreading around information that catches people's attention. But I want to dig in to some of those poll numbers specifically for a second here, Natalie, because I actually really appreciated you going through the distinction between forecasting and polling. But some of the actual polls, with the point, as you're making, that they weren't meant to be predictive. But I want to talk about the gap between the numbers in the polls versus what actually happened on election day. And here's why. Let's just take a look for a second at Wisconsin, for example. Okay, so on November 2nd, okay, the day before Election Day, CNBC had Biden up by 8 points in Wisconsin. On November 1st, the New York Times poll had Biden up by 11. The Reuters poll, also on November 1st, Biden at plus 10. On October 31st, CNN had Biden at plus 8. Now, of course, Wisconsin's doing a recount right now, but the numbers aren't likely to shift by major, you know, by a major percentage. But the first count out of Wisconsin, in reality, on Election Day, there was barely a percentage point between Joe Biden, President-elect Joe Biden, and Donald Trump. I mean, that's a huge gap. What accounts for that gap?
It is a large gap. And that's why I started saying up front, you know, before I said anything else, that it is clear that we have struggled to measure Trump support. And Wisconsin seems to be kind of ground zero for some of that. You know, I think Wisconsin is where those numbers, where those gaps are the largest between the polls and reality. So I think as pollsters, there are two places that we need to look. And you've heard a lot about one if you've been following this debate, but maybe not so much the other. The one that people have been talking about quite a bit is, are we just not getting these people in our polls? Mm-hmm. Are we not contacting the right people? Or is there something about these Trump voters that makes them unlikely to respond to polls? They don't trust the system. You know, Trump has activated their desire to vote in ways that no other politician ever has. And so that argument has been running around. And, you know, there's probably something to it. We do need to go back and assess, is our data catching the American population in the way that we think it is? You know, polling has done this throughout its history since it really got going in the 30s and 40s. You know, we see issues and we go back and we say, okay, how can we make sure that we're adequately representing all Americans? And the field's going to do that again.
So, Natalie, let me just jump in here because this capturing a truly representative sample is a huge issue, which, to your point, actually predates the last couple of election cycles.
Right.
And I wanted to play something that Scott Keeter told us from Pew about this. This was a major concern of his.
Survey non-cooperation is a massive problem, and it has gotten progressively worse over the past 40 years or so. If you look back at polling in the 60s and 70s, you could see response rates as high as 75 or 80%. Today, response rates are below 10%, and in some cases, considerably below 10%. People are busy. They don't have time. A lot of people are suspicious of whether invitations to take part in a survey are sincere or not. So all of those factors have contributed to make it more difficult to get cooperation.
So that's Scott Keeter, Senior Survey Advisor at the Pew Research Center in Washington. And Natalie, so just to underscore what he said, response rates to polls in the 70s in the United States, he was saying were like 60, 70%, and now they're regularly below 10%. Not just because of lack of institutional trust or people not wanting to say who they might vote for, but there's even, you know, a huge group of folks like me who ruthlessly screen their calls and won't pick up the phone if it's from a number they don't recognize. So how much of a challenge is the fact that it's really hard to even just capture a representative sample? How much is that part of the problem?
That is a substantial piece of the puzzle here. You know, for example, I do this for a living, and my phone rang 7 times yesterday with unknown numbers, and I didn't pick up any of them because they were not from area codes that I would expect business calls to be from. So, you know, if someone like me who does surveys and polling for a living does that, you know, what's our hope with everybody else? You know, the field is getting more innovative with how it reaches out to people. It is important to realize that although we've talked a lot about phone polling post-election, phone polling actually is making up kind of the minority of polls that we're seeing out there. More and more polling is being done on the internet, and the quality involved in that varies greatly.
Okay, so here's the you and Scott Keeter are of one mind here in terms of the issues in modern day polling. So he also talked about these online polls. Let's listen to that.
There were a lot of polls in the 2020 cycle, hundreds, if not thousands of them. Most of them were being done on the web, online, and most of them were being done with samples that were not random samples of the population, but were instead what are called opt-in survey panels, where people are offered financial or other kinds of rewards for taking surveys, but are able to simply volunteer to join. It's extremely controversial. It involves a lot of work statistically to try to adjust the results so that they look like the population, but it's not on the same firm foundation that polls that use random sampling are, those that use voter registration lists or random digit dialing or survey panels that are recruited using address-based sampling.
Mm-hmm. So that's Scott Keeter from Pew. Now, Natalie, he also said, and check me on this, that these online polls with their questionable methodology and not necessarily capturing a representative sample, all the issues that go along with an internet poll, that some of these online polls are then folded into the aggregators or the averages that are put out by other groups like Real Clear Politics, et cetera, that they're mixing online polls with the more traditional polling done by, Quinnipiac, et cetera. And so when we in the media quote the averages that come out of places like Real Clear Politics, we may be quoting from a number that's compromised with these online polls.
Yes, I would agree with that. No one is really sure what Real Clear Politics criteria is for inclusion in their aggregates. 538, I know, just takes basically every single poll that comes out publicly, unless they have reason to believe that it's fraud. And The Economist, who also runs an aggregate, takes most polls, but they have filtered out a few for quality reasons. But by and large, that's right. I mean, these aggregates are taking anything that comes their way because the theory is that more data is better. You'll hear these people say, throw it in the aggregate and let the aggregate sort it out. And I think that's where they could play a big gatekeeping role and really help the industry and help the ecosystem is by not taking just anything that comes their way.
Well, it's interesting that the polling data industry would say just more data is better data. I mean, a fundamental rule of data science is garbage in equals garbage out. So we're going to explore that a little bit more when we come back. Natalie Jackson, hang on for a second. Natalie is helping us understand the trials and tribulations and purposes of the modern polling industry. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are taking a look at the polling industry in the United States. And yes, asking why in November 2020 we had similar outcomes as in November 2016, i.e. the polls got it wrong in certain places. But we're taking a deeper look and we're asking, okay, if polling isn't quite providing the kind of information that a healthy democracy needs to understand itself, where else might we get that information? I'm joined today by Natalie Jackson. She's Research Director at Public Religion Research Institute, PRRI, and also Adjunct Professor at American University. And Natalie, in the previous segment, you had said that there were two reasons that you had for why some of the polling didn't quite land right this time around in November 2020. And the first one was the idea that the samples weren't capturing people who ended up voting for President Trump. But then you said there's a second reason, and I didn't let you get to that second reason, and I wanted to give you a chance to do that now.
Sure. So the second thing that we haven't heard as much about is that what polls do when they estimate likely voters is they're taking a sample of all Americans or of registered voters, and they're using some questions or some modeling techniques to identify whether they think those people are actually going to turn out to vote. Those are guesses, and every pollster does it a little bit differently. There's not much transparency about how any given pollster does that. It's kind of the secret sauce part of polling that we really just don't have much visibility around. And so I think the public and in the media just don't have a lot of understanding of what goes into that, of course, unless the media has their own in-house experts. I wonder how much we are getting these people into our polls, but we're screening them out thinking that they won't vote. Huh. Or they're being swamped out by too many people who don't actually turn out to vote getting through. You know, often we're doing this by asking people directly, do you plan to vote? We saw a lot of enthusiasm among Democrats this year for voting. But then there's some early evidence that maybe in areas where the pandemic was hitting harder, turnout was lower. You know, maybe these people had every expectation that they would go vote, but then they didn't. Or there are people in our data who typically are not that enthusiastic about voting, but they did get enthusiastic about Trump. And so maybe they were more blasé in answer to our questions about voting, but they did vote. Mm-hmm. So the second place I would look is how we're generating likely voters. And, you know, if I were to hazard a guess, I would say, you know, reality is probably somewhere in between both of those things, and that they're both acting in the same direction in this case to cause polling misses.
Interesting. Okay, so I'm going to come back to this in a few minutes, Natalie, because it's sort of the art versus the science of polling question, which we'll come back around to. But yesterday, in preparation for this show, I did ask On Point listeners if they'd ever been called by a pollster. And how they responded to it. We got several people sharing their stories. So here's what On Point listeners experienced.
I stopped answering pollsters who called several years ago, in part because they did not identify themselves. And many of the questions, I just learned that they just pigeonhole you. So you can't really give your honest opinion to a question.
Nobody asks what's on your mind. They ask what's on their mind. And it's a crucial distinction because it ends up with inaccurate polls.
The questions that were asked demanded nuanced answers, but only accepted yes or no answers. If this call was at all typical of other polling calls, it's no wonder they were so far off. It was little more than guesswork.
So those were On Point listeners from Missouri, Iowa, and Ohio. And given the topic of this hour today, I will, of course, emphasize that that was not a representative sample at all. Those were the people who chose to call us with their stories. But Natalie, about that last one from the Ohio caller who said, you know, he wanted to probably give a nuanced answer, but he was just told yes, no. Can you respond to that? Because I think a lot of people wonder about that when we're, especially when they're asked about really complex issues, racial justice, criminal justice reform, the economy. Like, how can they give a yes no answer to some of these questions?
You know, that is a perfectly fair criticism of a lot of what polling does. We do try to put things into categories for analysis. We try to put people into categories. And that is one of the downsides, is that when you're trying to generate data that you can look at on a large scale, you do lose some of the nuance. So, you know, the frustrations that those listeners shared are valid. You know, that is something that gets lost when we try to do large scale surveys. Now, we do sometimes ask open-ended questions that do allow people to just freely give their opinion, but those are not as common as maybe they should be. And we use other tools like focus groups or interviews or, you know, even social media analysis to try to fill in more of the in-depth nuance of those questions. You know, the polls are trying to give us an overarching view of where the whole country stands. Mm-hmm. So by its very nature, you lose some of the nuance. And, you know, I certainly hear that frustrates people.
Yeah. Well, Natalie, I am going to give you a little bit of a break here for a few minutes for being our stand-in for the entire polling industry. Because, look, the truth is that, yes, there's been a lot of focus on polling from 2016 to 2020, in part because, to your point earlier, there is a big industry, like a media polling politics industry built around this. And we're all constantly searching for ways to get good information about this democracy. And at the same time, though, there's been issues with polling long before 2016. I mean, in fact, polls, if you really want to be brutal about it, they have a history of getting it wrong.
You know, people these days would say, yeah, the polls were wrong somehow in 2016 because they didn't get the Trump election correct. And they may have a vague recollection or vague understanding of the 1948 election, having seen that famous photograph of Harry Truman holding up the front page of the Chicago Tribune that proclaimed Dewey defeats Truman, but not much else.
That's W. Joseph Campbell, professor of communication studies at American University and author of Lost in a Gallup, Polling Failure in U.S. Presidential Elections. Now, you've probably seen that picture that he's talking about, the one of a victorious Harry Truman in 1948 holding up the newspaper. Well, part of the reason Truman's win was such a surprise, one of the nation's most influential pollsters at the time, Bud Roper, he had a poll putting Dewey up over Truman by almost 15 points. The New York Times had endorsed Dewey, so had two of the biggest papers in Harry Truman's own home state. And so Bud Roper, he stopped polling. Again, this is in 1948, but he stopped polling 5 weeks before the election because really, what was the point? Well, Campbell told us a lot more about Bud Roper.
Well, he was the son of one of the pioneering opinion researchers. The pioneering guy was Elmo Roper. And he started his opinion surveys in the mid-1930s, at about the same time that George Gallup and Archibald Crossley were doing their surveys. Elmo Roper was sort of a contrarian pollster. He had reservations about election polling. He didn't think much of it. By 1948, he was openly calling election polling a stunt. He was still doing election polling, but he was not really enamored with the whole technique and what it purported to show. And 1948, of course, was the huge embarrassment for the pollsters, for Roper, Gallup, and Crossley, because this was the Dewey defeats Truman election, when Harry S. Truman defied the polls, the press, the pundits, and won re-election in a fashion that no one anticipated. It just shocked everybody.
Republican committees worked at tally sheets, waiting hopefully for the landslide that had ground itself to a halt. President Truman's early lead picked up nationwide momentum, and the GOP seemed doomed.
I suspect the shock of 1948 was probably greater than that of 2016 when Donald Trump won the presidency.
President Truman's victory was a milestone of the century in our nation's election history.
Well, Bud Roper was a newcomer to polling in 1948. That was the first year he was associated with his father's firm. And his introduction to polling was that polling debacle in which the Roper organization got the election wrong by nearly 19 percentage points, almost as bad as the Literary Digest in 1936. I think Bud Roper was picking up on some of his father's tepid views about polling and the value of this. Does it really tell us a lot that we wouldn't otherwise know in a few days or a few hours or a few weeks? Opinion research, he said, was part art and part science, and sometimes it was more art than science. And when he was making those comments, he was pointing to the way in which pollsters determine who is most likely to vote. Among their respondents, pollsters get people who say, yeah, I'm going to turn out and vote and do my constitutional good deed and vote. But many people don't. Even in this year's election, the 2020 election, we had a high turnout election, but a third of the eligible voters in the country did not vote, roughly. So it's a real delicate proposition to determine who's going to vote and who is not. And pollsters have their own methodology, they have their own techniques for making that kind of determination, and they certainly are far from foolproof. That's not science. And this is something that pollsters have been grappling with since the early days of modern opinion research, since the days of Elmo Roper and George Gallup and Archibald Crossley. I mean, they recognize the difficulty of getting the likely voter in the sample, and it continues to be a conundrum today. A lot of pollsters say that what we do is not prediction. We take snapshots at a moment in time of what people are thinking, and I kind of think that's a bit of a cop-out. I kind of think that pollsters are offering us predictions, especially since there's so many pollsters out there these days, that their snapshots, taken often during an election campaign, are going to tell us something. They're telling us something about what's likely to happen. They're giving us clues as to what the electorate is going to decide on election day. At the same time, however, the public and journalists as well should treat polls a little skeptically, recognizing that these are not necessarily oracles.
It's W. Joseph Campbell, professor of communications at American University and author of Lost in a Gallup, Polling Failure in U.S. Presidential Elections. Well, Natalie Jackson, Professor Campbell there, he touched on a lot of the things that we've been discussing, right? The challenge of really discerning who's a likely voter, forecasting versus actual polling, capturing a truly representative sample, how the media reports on polls. All of these issues apparently have been with us for more than the past two election cycles. But I wanted to end today's conversation in the last few minutes coming back around to where we started, which is this assertion that polling serves a democratic purpose, small d democratic purpose, that it provides us with information about the electorate that is difficult to gather in any other way. And I wanted to challenge that because we're living in a world where people are throwing out data about themselves, just walking around with their phones in their pockets. The campaigns themselves have incredible data mining arms to them, armies of people who are trying to understand Americans' attitudes about their country through data other than polling. So aren't there other ways to get information about folks rather than traditional polls?
There certainly are, but I would argue that polls are the only way to get a large number of all Americans. You know, when campaigns and analysts use other sources of data, they're looking for very different things than simply the opinions of a group of Americans. They're looking for possible persuadable people. They're looking for people that need a little push to get out to vote. You know, the variety of reasons that campaigns and parties have these large data science operations are different than what drives most public polling. What drives most public polling is simply to represent what large portions of Americans think. If Donald Trump stands up there and says, no Americans support having transgender people serve in the military, we can come along and say, well, actually, a PRRI poll found that close to 70% of people support having transgender people serve in the military. You know, if Donald Trump stands up and says, I'm running away with this election, we have polls that push back on that.
Yeah.
They may not have been precise, but we had a check on claims that, if believed, could do damage to society.
So I'm going to just jump in here because I think this is extraordinarily important, right? We as a nation need means by which to understand each other that aren't driven by a campaign, that aren't driven by propaganda, that aren't driven by the information or the influence that money can buy. And that is why I think all of us, we need polling to work. We need polling to not fall prey to all of these problems that we've been talking about this hour. We've just got about 30 seconds left, Natalie. Do you think there's been enough of a reckoning now over the past couple of cycles that we will have an advancement, not just in terms of how polling is done or the forecast, but also we in the media, like, to do a better job at this if it serves such an important purpose in this country?
You know, polls will continue to have issues from time to time, as they have throughout the history of the field. And pollsters will continue to improve their craft in order to fulfill this goal, to accurately reflect public opinion. I would challenge that why should I trust polls is not the question anyone should be asking. Why did you ever trust them to show you an unknowable future? And to get back to a place where we don't expect them to show us an unknowable future, that entire ecosystem of pollsters, public, media, and forecasters and aggregators all need to work together to stop perpetuating the mirage that it tells us the future.
Natalie Jackson is research director at PRRI and an adjunct professor at American University. Natalie, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, continuing to test hypotheses. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.